Okay, so I give you Dr. Rothschild.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Mark. I'm going to be talking about a psychoanalytic approach to substance use treatment. And just to be clear, I am not talking about classical four times a week on the couch psychoanalysis. What I'm going to do is introduce and explore just some fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis, particularly from relational psychoanalysis, and talk about how they can, I think, not just enhance, but be really instrumental in substance use treatment. What I actually do in practice is a very integrated approach, and please, please keep that in mind as I'm speaking, that what I'm talking about is integrating psychoanalytic ideas into cognitive behavioral and whatever other approaches you may use, and the more common approaches. I do a lot of sort of behavioral coaching. So when I speak and teach often, I talk about the specific behavioral work that I do and then put it in the analytic context. I'm not going to do that today because we only have an hour and because it's oftentimes covered and because we're psychologists and most of us know those anyway. So, but just don't forget, as pointed out in slide one, this is an integrated approach. Okay, so remember that what I'm talking about is the sort of the context and the way of thinking in which the behavioral coaching, the spiritual work, the whatever other work you may be doing will happen. Okay? So I identify myself as a psychologist and a psychoanalyst. I also identify as a substance use therapist until very recently when I decided not to renew it. I was actually a KSAC. And that surprises people a lot, that I am a psychoanalyst. It's actually my primary identity, but that I'm also very much identified as a substance use therapist because they don't go together a whole lot. And in fact, some of you may know that analysts have been treating and writing about substance misuse for decades, but there's really just a small portion, I think, of the addiction treatment community and of the psychoanalytic community who know that literature or who do this work. There is this sort of some people who are very well known, Wormser, Kantian, Henry Crystal, but it's a small group. I think it's not surprising that psychoanalytic ideas have been ignored for a long time because certainly we know that historically many psychoanalysts in the really classical Freudian psychoanalytic way dramatically failed substance-using patients. Right? There was this sort of traditional model of analytic abstinence where the patient free associated and the analyst didn't bring anything up. And so if the patient didn't bring up their substance use, they could be lying on the couch three or four times a week, and their addiction, you know, we hear these stories about these sort of flagrant, obvious problems getting worse and worse, never being addressed. And so, of course, psychoanalysis developed this terrible reputation, and substance use treatment developed completely separately from it. That, I really don't think, happens very much, if at all, anymore, I certainly hope. But maybe it was in response to those failures, but also something happened, I think, on the substance use side, which was a treatment system developed that completely ignored not just psychoanalytic concepts, but for a long time, any psychological aspects, right? The idea was basically accept that you have a disease, get sober, go to AA, go to rehab, that's what we'll teach you. And so there was sort of an ignoring of anything that might have underlied any kind of substance use. And the psychology involved. And now, I think today, currently, both fields, or psychology in general, psychoanalysis specifically, and substance use treatment are all growing and changing. And this recent growth and the modifications that are happening in both fields is what I think is now allowing psychoanalytic ideas back into substance use treatment. Because in psychoanalysis, there's now a greatly increased flexibility about what constitutes analytic work. And there is this relational turn, which is moving psychoanalytic practice from a rather authoritarian position, which was what we called a one-person psychology, where there was this sort of authority analyst, imposing interpretations on the patient who was the patient, the one being observed, and the psychology was only of that patient, to a two-person psychology where we work within a mutual understanding and a co-construction of meaning. And simultaneously, in substance use treatment, there is an increased acceptance of what I'm going to call, refer to as harm reduction therapy. And that often brings immediate responses from people because they think harm reduction therapy means moderation, and then there's all kind of, we can be, have all kinds of debate about that, separate topic. Certainly moderation as a goal for some people is part of harm reduction therapy. But there are other aspects of harm reduction therapy that come specifically from that movement that I think are infusing all of substance use treatment now. And these are factors that are described consistently and explicitly in all the harm reduction clinical literature. And that is an individualized approach to treatment, looking at people. You know, we say meeting the patient where the patient is at and in individualizing treatment, and a mutual thinking of the treatment as a mutual collaborative endeavor between client and therapist. So if you notice, what's happening is that both substance use treatment and psychoanalysis are transforming from models of authoritarian kind of teacher therapist and passive accepting patient to models of mutuality and collaboration. Harm reduction therapy works with clients as whole people, right? It sort of avoids labels like addict and doesn't focus only on modifying a behavior, but harm reduction therapists are open to whatever problems or issues the client presents and are interested in looking at the meaning and function that substance use serves. And that whole person approach and that interest in the meaning and function that underlies substance use is really psychoanalysis. That's psychoanalytic. So, everybody with me so far?
Yep, so far, so good.
Okay, good. So, look at the PowerPoint, your slide on what do I mean by analytic. Okay, what is psychodynamic or psychoanalytic? And let's talk a little bit about that and then get more specific into relational. So, one of the defining characteristics of a psychoanalytic approach is that the analyst and the client are open and curious in their positions vis-a-vis each other and about the client's dynamics and motivations. So I was taught in analytic training that a cornerstone of psychoanalysis is curiosity. Not only do we want to learn about our client, but one of our primary goals is to help our clients become curious and learn about themselves, to become curious about how their mind works, what makes them tick, what motivates them, how do they protect themselves emotionally, how do they operate in the world. To become curious, to be able to look at what things might we assume are givens, but are really constructions based on our own unique history that don't have to be assumed or given, right, that can actually be looked at and questioned. Because once we're curious and questioning, then we can open up to new possibilities. Because we can begin to articulate things that were never articulated. We can formulate things that never had a formulation, even as a question. Couldn't be asked before. Because there were no words, there was no formulation of it. And then once we can articulate something, we can look at it, we can examine it, and then we can choose to change it. Right? Also in psychoanalytic work, sessions don't follow a program or an agenda. And that's very different from the more traditional substance use treatment, right? It's just the opposite. We listen, but we also don't listen for what we think we already know or for what's expected. Most importantly, we listen for what's unexpected, what's new, what piques our curiosity, because we want to learn what we don't already know. And I think you'll see that in some of the clinical examples, how the element of surprise, I have a teacher who actually wrote a book that talks about courting surprise. Because that's really what we want to do, right? Because that's where change comes, in the surprise, in the sudden noticing of something, call it insight if you will. So then if we move on to a psychoanalytic approach to treating substance use, right, that's I think the next slide, I actually think of it, it's the same. I don't treat my substance users very differently than I do the rest of my patients. Of course, it's a topic for conversation, so the content may be different, but how I think and how I approach them is not so different because I still see each patient as a whole human being who's coming in for help because of some kind of suffering. And I think that's really important, because I think in this approach, it's really important not to label or categorize or limit our interest only to substance misuse. Right? There's no plan before somebody walks in. Somebody walks in and we just listen and explore, because we want to know this person. And as I was saying before about psychoanalysis in general, we want to help this person know themselves. So as analysts, what we do is we witness. Witnessing is really important, sort of witnessing somebody's story, sharing it with them. We accept, we put things together for them in a new way, and try to open new possibilities for looking at the self and the world. And then through those new expanded possibilities, and very importantly, through the new experiences of whatever happens in the relationship with us, that's where the helping happens. Right. So in general, we're open and curious, focusing on the whole person, not just focusing on a specific behavior, even if that behavior is dangerous and scary. And also, in the case of substance use therapy, in an analytic approach, we understand that like anything else that somebody does or that we may consider a symptom, substance use has function and meaning. And we're curious about that for that particular person. And one of the reasons that's so important, of course, is because we need to know what somebody's going to be losing. Right? We can't just help someone stop or cut down without knowing what it is that they're going to lose if they stop doing that. We need to know what we have to help them replace. Right. So there are many sort of more general psychoanalytic, I don't want to say answers, but maybe orientations towards looking at the question of meaning and function of a substance, right? And I find that really fascinating and could talk for at least an hour just about that. But let's just sort of say in general, and again, within this, we look at each individual very much specifically and what their story is. But we can talk about the drug as an object, right? Meaning in analytic talk, the drug is a relational object, right? And for those who have no background in psychoanalysis, a relational object is something or someone a person has a relationship with, both in the real world and in their mind. And we know that people have very important, often complicated relationships with their substances, right? And so those are always worth exploring. Both the real world, the sort of getting it, taking it, what that does, but also the fantasies around it, the symbolism around it, the relationship in the mind, right? So we can talk about a substance as an object of desire, as a satisfier of needs. I've had many people talk about it like an abusive relationship, but which hurts, but feels oh so compelling, right? Or substance taking is an action one takes to soothe oneself, to feel better, or not to feel at all. Of course, there are still probably some classical analysts who would talk about a drug or a substance as a satisfier of drives, maybe oral drives, and what that might mean. That's not my language or my way of thinking, but it's interesting. And then, again, more relationally, Joyce McDougall, who some of you have probably heard of, she frames the substance, she talks about substance use, and she talks about a substance as a transitional object, you know, like a teddy bear to a three-year-old. Mm. Hold it for comfort, right? And I think it really works that way to think about a substance as a transitional object. And then there are many people who talk about substances as an aid to managing overwhelming emotions. Henry Crystal is somebody who writes very eloquently about overwhelming emotions and how substances help to manage them. And he talks about alexithymia. Also, people who use substances often don't even have language for emotion, which is what makes it so overwhelming. So, as I said, I'm a relational analyst, if you look at the relational analyst slide. And so I think about all those things. But an underlying focus always, always in relational psychoanalysis is relationships and the psychotherapeutic relationship, right? So relationships that my client has in real life and has had in real life, the relationships my client carries in mind, and then very importantly and always, the relationship between my client and myself, the dynamics, the what's happening between us at any given moment and how that impacts on treatment, the nonverbal process aspects of treatment. So I guess that sort of, that pretty much summarizes the aspects on the PowerPoint slide there. But I wanted to sort of review some of those factors. And then we'll stop for some questions and then move on to specifics and more specific clinical work. Okay. So the idea of relationships being fundamental, right? Fundamental in life, in history, right, in development, and in treatment. So I imagine we're all aware of attachment theory, right? The idea that early attachments profoundly influence later development, right? And we also know that in current life, there is a strong connection between loneliness, stress and depression, and then often substance misuse. Right? People with strong support systems, whether those are family, friends, newfound supports in 12-step programs or other programs or groups, those people who have stronger support tend to have greater success in stopping or modifying their use. Right? And then, of course, the treatment relationship matters. Even for something as behavioral as substance misuse, therapy is not just about learning new skills. I don't think you can just teach somebody the skills without it having a context of a supportive relationship and sort of being aware of what happens within that. And then relationships are external and internal. So when we talk about relational concepts, as I've been saying, right, there are relationships that exist in the real world, like I was talking about, but then there's also those that are carried in mind, the symbolic ones, right? And examples might be like the person who's still trying to impress the demanding father of their youth, even if that father is long ago gone or mellowed with age, or the person just now is, you know, grown up and has their own family. That demanding father's voice still lives in their head all the time. Whether or not they've identified it as this is my father, it may have taken on their own voice or a different voice. But those messages continue, right? Punitive voices, whether parental or others, can live in the mind for years, forever if they're not addressed, right? Well after they're gone from the actual life of the patient, of the person. And similarly, soothing voices, a sense of protection and safety develops within because it was originally provided externally by parenting or other caretaking figures. And so that's what I mean by internal relationships. And then also sometimes objects can become affected with the characteristics or functions of a relationship, like a teddy bear can, a transitional object, right? And a substance can too. It can take the place of a soothing other. It can also be a very destructive other, an alluring but ultimately abusive relationship, one that feels really good in the moment of love, of soothing, but hurts and can be very hard to break up with, but especially so when there are not many other supports to replace it. And I think that's really important when we think about substance misuse and we think about function and symbolic meaning of use and what it means for someone to give it up. And then the last on the relational psychoanalysis slide is the relationships between parts of the self. And I'm going to spend much of the rest of the time talking about that, as well as the idea that the last two, that all of this is based in a treatment that relies on process, those nonverbal dynamics that I was talking about. So I want to stop now, ask if there are any questions and comments. The reason I'm going to spend most of the time on the parts of the self is because I think that's the part that's sort of least, that's very, very relevant to this use and least often addressed and or thought about in this context or, yeah, certainly in this context. So I'm going to stop, see if there are any questions or comments, but let's not take too much time because the rest of the time I think is more clinical and more complicated, and so let's spend more time on that. But any questions or comments so far?
Hi. I have a question about, you said that you treat your patients with addictions in a similar way to you treat other patients.
Yes.
Are there any ways in which you do something differently?
And yes.
The related
there
question
are.
To that is, how do you account for the choice of that particular symptom, of substance use as a symptom?
Well, the substance use as a symptom accounting, I think, is very individual, like with everything else. I think the answer to that question would be that I look at them the same way I look at anybody else. who comes into my office, why did you choose, an eating disorder, or why does your anxiety come up around work but not relationships, whatever it might be. So why did you choose substance use? Sometimes it's genetic. I mean, there's very frequently in many of my patients a genetic component, and we talk about that was their vulnerability because of their biology. And sometimes it's also learned behaviors, and sometimes it's sociocultural because of the environment somebody's in. So there's all that, of course. But then also why the particular substance is, I think, a very psychological answer. Why does one person feel better with a cocaine or an amphetamine feeling? Why does somebody else feel better with an opiate? Why does somebody else feel better? I find many people find, for example, marijuana, who have ADD, because it helps them focus. You know, so that kind of thing is often looking at what is being medicated, self-medication hypothesis. But what I do that's different is the specific behavioral work, obviously. I do a lot of behavioral coaching. I do a lot of moderation work, and I do a lot of abstinence work, and I do mostly fluid work, figuring out if moderation or abstinence is right for you. Many people come in thinking they can moderate and discovering they can't, and it's wonderful when they discover they can't, because then they're internally motivated to be abstinent rather than because somebody told them to. So I do a lot of that kind of coaching work, behavioral work, and often I also, more than with any other patient, have to work with a team where I will refer somebody to a group that may be running at a local IOP program, or sometimes have to refer them to an inpatient rehab and then work with that rehab to have them come back to me. So those are the ways it's different.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
This is Ann.
Yeah, hi.
Can you say a little bit about, the interface of your psychotherapy with medicine?
I refer many people to psychiatrists for medicine, only addiction psychiatrists who I know well, and I usually collaborate with them. They choose the medicines if necessary. Medicines can be an antidepressant. It can be often an opiate replacement. And, you know, usually we just sort of keep in touch with each other looking for anything that either of us should know that's going on with the patient.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Does that answer your question? Sure. Anybody else, or should we move on to the more detailed, the more clinical parts? Okay, all right. So I want to talk about the relationships between the parts of the self concept, okay? So what I mean psychoanalytically when I talk about that is the concept of self-states and dissociation. And these are ideas that I work with a lot with my substance using clients. I work with them a lot with many clients, but particularly with substance using clients. So let me show you how this looks and what I mean by that. So for those who are not familiar with the concept of self-states, just think about this. So we all have different ways of being at different times, right? Under varying circumstances, we embody what are called varying self-states. Right now, we're probably all in our professional self-state. And we may be very different, particularly given that it's Friday night, tonight, or tomorrow. Different people, as well as any one person at different times, can be more or less aware that various self-states can exist for themselves. So for some people, there's a discontinuity, sort of barriers, between various aspects of self. And for them, when in one self state, they are unable to access or even remember that there is the potential to be another way. And we call that dissociation, right? So, as I just said, different people and the same person at different times can be more or less dissociated. Dissociation exists on a continuum, and of course we all dissociate some self-states at some times, the parts of ourselves that feel like not me, that we don't want to have as me, or we don't recognize as part of me, right? But some people, particularly people who have experienced trauma, are much more dissociated than others. For them, Whoever they are in the moment is who they always are. There is no other possible way of being. For them, there is an inability to hold conflicting or different views of self simultaneously. Okay? And there's a very strong connection to trauma with this, which I don't really have time to get into. But if you think when trauma happens, the definition of trauma is it's too big to process. That's what makes something traumatic. So it's too big to hold in mind. It's too big to have words for. The way to protect yourself from trauma is to make it happen not to you, not to your core self. And so dissociation happens as a structure to save the self, but then it also can harden and become a way of being. Okay? Does that make sense to people? And there is, as we know, a strong connection often between trauma and substance misuse. So trauma, substance misuse, and dissociation go together frequently. All right? So in dissociation, there is a capacity for parts of me to be not me. All right, now let that sink for a minute. So what happens then is the inability to conceive of other possible ways of being when in one way of being results in an impoverished capacity for self-reflection. Because there's a tendency to fully believe that any immediate subjective experience is absolute truth. Right? And if the one way you are is the only way you could be, there are no possible other selves, no other possible ways to be, there is no experience of conflict. You can't take perspective and look at your larger self. You can't see two different possibilities at the same time. So there's no conflict. So this is graphically how I think of it. This sort of came to me one day when I was talking about this, and it really seems to capture it for me. So imagine you have a piece of paper, and on your piece of paper, in big letters, are the letters written separately from each other. S-E-L-F. Hold that paper close up to your eye with just the L in view, way up to one of your eyes, right? Close the other eye. The world is L. You are sure the world is L. From end to end of your vision, the world is L. You're absolutely seeing the world. It's L. Now hold the paper away. Have perspective. Suddenly, you can see there is also S, E, and F. There are more letters, each an entity unto itself. And together, they form a gestalt. The whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and all the parts matter. Each part is different, and together, they make self. So seeing only the L is dissociation. When you see only the L, there's no idea that there could be other parts that make up self. Okay, get that? So for me, this is really important to enhancing the possibility of successive treatment. I mean, for me, in general, in psychoanalytic treatment, this sort of a goal is to help people see the different aspects of self and hold them together and integrate them more. But particularly for substance use treatment, right, where one of the treatment aims is to get to people to be curious, to know themselves better, to begin to recognize different possibilities, right? One of the things we do is to help people hold the possibility of sobriety when they're using or when they want to use. Right? And this isn't about just feeling differently. It's not just remembering I can have a different feeling or a different interest. It goes much deeper because it reaches what we think of as our core sense of who we are, who we have always been, how we identify ourselves. Right? A way to describe this, my psychoanalytic mentor, teacher and still supervisor at the moment, is Philip Bromberg. And he calls this standing in the spaces. He says, The idea is to stand in the spaces between realities without losing any of them, observing and reflecting upon the existence of other selves. So we need to bring together the part of the person who uses with the part of the person that wants to be healthy and safe. So one of the things we do in substance use treatment, I think all of us, even you know, working very behaviorally, is help people remember why they don't want to use in the face of wanting to use. Right? But I think something that's important to think about here is if somebody is truly dissociated, that's going to be really hard to do because they can't feel the conflict in the moment. Right? So the person who comes to therapy, who walks into your office, is usually the self who wants to get help. So the person in your office asking for help or making a plan with you to stay sober may well not be the same person, the same self, who uses drugs or drinks outside in the world. Right? Or if somebody's not coming in voluntarily asking for help, if they're mandated to treatment, the part of themselves that uses might not want to come in at all because you are threatening that part. Right? You want that part to go away. So if somebody's really dissociated, there's a good chance that you're not accessing the using part of the person when the part that wants to get healthy, that wants to stop using, is with you. And you might not know that. How often, this happens to me all the time, people make plans to be sober, they're really committed, right? They're really dedicated, I really don't want to use anymore, and you have this great plan. You know, and I make these plans with people like, okay, I'm going to bring my gym bag to work so I don't go to the bar after work. I go directly to the gym, or I'm going to take a cab home so I don't, or I'm going to delete my dealer's numbers from my phone, right? And they're totally, totally committed to this. And then they come back really confused, really disappointed, really ashamed because they didn't stick to the plan. And often it's because the plan was made in one self state and the part of themselves that uses wasn't involved. And so we have to bridge those gaps between dissociated self states. And one of the things we do, I think now this is really common because of motivational interviewing, is have our patients explore the pros and cons. You make a cost-benefit analysis of using. But an important part of this that's not always emphasized is the work to feel them, to recognize them simultaneously, to experience conflict about it. Not to be able to list them and sort of go back and forth rapidly between them, but to feel conflict. And that's not always easy, of course, because sometimes people can't, but to really work on that with somebody in the office. I mean, if they can recognize conflict and feel it with you, then hopefully they can take it outside. And my goal always, I tell people, my goal is for you to feel the conflict and make a decision. My goal isn't to tell you that you're not supposed to use and you not use because I told you so. What I want is for you to be able to make a conscious decision at any time.
I can walk through.
I want to help
Debbie, can I interrupt? I just want to remind everybody to check your mute button because I hear somebody in the background. It's a little distracting. So if you could all check that you're on mute, I appreciate it. Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that because I was hearing it too. So my goal is always to say what I want is I want to help you evaluate clearly and make a decision. Because too often when people come back disappointed and ashamed and baffled, they feel like they say, I don't know what happened. I just don't know. People can describe almost like being on autopilot and once again doing what was habitual. Habit is a really strong, right, is a very strong factor here too. But the notion of being able to be present and make a decision is, I think, so important. You know, how many times people say, I don't know what happened. I suddenly found myself standing in front of the bar. And one of the things we do there is to sort of track it back and figure out, okay, at what point did you become conscious? Well, I vaguely remember thinking, oh, I'm walking. It's a long walk. I'm going to have to go to the bathroom. I know there's an open bathroom in the bar. And, oh, that'd be nice anyway because I really haven't seen Johnny the bartender for a long time. So I get to say hi. And next thing you know, you're drinking. And right. So there's that. But there's also sometimes this sense of just sort of that the knowledge, the part of the person of not wanting to use is just gone, right? They weren't part of, or this part that's now deciding to go to the bar just wasn't part of that plan of wanting to not use. So we need to sort of bring these things together, and I try to help people become conscious so they can make a conscious decision so they know what they're doing. Because doing things on autopilot, there's so much shame, but also what happens, I think, is for the therapist feels often disappointed, lied to. People will say, you lied, you said you were on board and you weren't. And I think dissociation is one of the reasons that so often people who have addictions are called liars, and it's, I think, a horrible stereotype. So I think we really need to think about what's going on. What are the dynamics here? And sometimes, often, they are dissociative dynamics. So here's an example, a clinical example of something that happened. I had a patient who left my office over and over again, very clear that she no longer wanted to drink. She drank in a really scary way. She fell downstairs twice while I was seeing her. She would do really dangerous things. So, I mean, she really, really didn't want to. And she was afraid she was going to lose her job, too. And then over and over again, she said she felt like a zombie in a trance, walking on autopilot into the liquor store the very night we had talked about it. And it was a really long time before the part of her that took over and bought vodka would come to therapy and express herself. This was, as you might gather, a very traumatized woman who was significantly dissociated. And here's how dissociated she was. She was telling me about buying vodka and drinking, and she said, quote, "It scares me that I went along with that. It scares me that I went along with that, going to buy the vodka." So that's courting surprise, hearing something that is really surprising and unexpected, right? So I pointed out that sentence to her, like, "It scares you that you went along with that yourself, that you were doing? What?" And I had been, I sort of talk about self states in different parts of a person to my patients. So she had the language then for me to say, this is what I've been talking about, right? And it was such a shocking sentence to her that she had said that she then could recognize what I had been trying to describe to her and become curious about it, that her mind worked that way. And so that was a real turning point moment. That, along with, I had always been doing this, urging and making it very clear that I don't want to threaten the part of her who wants to drink. That allowed her to bring it in and to open up and to start talking about how drinking helps her, how it's the only time she feels whole in her body, right? How it's the only time she doesn't feel terribly anxious. But it was making it clear that I honored and would protect that part that allowed her, I think, to bring that in. And I think this is something also that it's one of the biggest challenges, I think, at least for me and many of the people I supervise, is that the part of the patient who uses will probably feel threatened by the therapy, by you, by the therapist. Because it can seem like the goal of treatment is to kill off that part, or at least to silence it, to send it underground. And mostly, the part of the patient who's sitting in therapy with you, if they came to you voluntarily especially, if they're coming in for help with this, that part of the patient is going to want to send their using part underground and silenced also. So the risk is forming a collusion with your patient around silencing the addicted or overusing part. And it can feel like a really good idea when overusing is dangerous and destructive to make it go away. But the problem is it doesn't work because you can't kill off parts of person. You can only send them underground. And if you send them underground, they're going to keep acting just in nonverbal, subtle ways, right? You can't ignore, and psychoanalysts particularly know, that all aspects of a person, the conscious, the unconscious, the owned and dissociated, all significant and all impact who we are and all influence how we feel and behave. And actually, that reminds me then of harm reduction therapists who focus on the entire individual and state that they do. And so I think that's how this all fits in together now and why there's room to think about this now. Does everybody know the saying in AA, that's my disease talking, right? It's a saying, yeah. I think, that many of us, we use it, that's my disease talking. Here's your collusion. This is what happens. Be careful of this, I think. So your patient says something like, you know, I was thinking, it's been a long time that I haven't had a drink, and I really think that I could probably have one or two now. I'm going to try that. Or your patient says, I really miss my drug-using friends. I can see them and not use. And then your patient says, oh, that's my disease talking. I know. Right? Indicating, I know that's really dangerous. I know I should ignore that thought. I'm not going to do that. And as a therapist, you're really relieved that your patient recognizes the danger, and you're just as happy to say, yep, that's your disease talking. But what that does is it shuts it down. It's not going to make what underlies it, the desire, go away. It's going to make it go away from the therapy. And your patient and you will feel really relieved, right? But whatever was really going on didn't disappear. So as analysts, we have to welcome all thoughts, even scary ones. So in that situation, when my patient says, that's my disease talking, I say, great, that's who I want to have talking in here. Let's let it talk, please, right? So I might say, you said maybe I can drink. It sounds like you'd really want to. What would it do for you? What are you missing without it? Right? It's sad that that would be so dangerous for you. We know it would be. But let's open it up and talk about it, because maybe we can find something else that can help. Or at least maybe we can acknowledge together how sad it is that having that drink would have such negative consequences and how much you would really love it. I'm not saying now, by the way, that if the person's language is that's my disease talking and it helps them when they find themselves standing outside the bar, go for it. I'm not saying don't, you know, shut that down there. That's a dangerous moment. But in session with you, or even once they can learn, and this is really, I think, also a goal, is for them to learn that an urge is a message to themselves that they need something right now. Maybe they can figure out then what they're feeling rather than just quickly push it away and find some way to satisfy it some other way. Like, yeah, it would feel really good to see those friends. Gee, maybe you're lonely. Maybe there's somebody you do need to see or call, right? So really important, your patient has to feel that the using part of themselves is welcome in treatment, that we know that the using part is generally the part that is most hurt and most in need of our help, and we want to hear directly from it. We don't want to just hear about it. We want to hear from it. We want it to come into the room. I had a supervisee who told me that she asked me to supervise her after she read one of my articles, and it completely turned around a paper she had felt stuck in, a treatment she had felt stuck in. So this woman had a patient who was desperate to get sober from alcohol. He would have one-night binges over and over again and then be sober for a couple of weeks and then have a binge. And he would come in so frustrated, disgusted with himself, so confused about why had he binged when he was so clear about the damage it did and how much he wanted to stop. And she was a really good, kind, caring, supportive therapist, not judgmental with him. And she would non-judgmentally support him. She would explore what happened. Let's talk about what you learned from the binge. What can you learn for the future? And join with him in his desire to stop, right? Encourage him to keep trying. But after she learned about dissociation and inviting the parts in that uses, he told her with great shame one day about yet another slip with a big binge that night. And she simply looked at him and said, was it fun? He was completely taken by surprise, she said, and she said she could see the shift in his eyes and his face, like he shifted self-states. And he said, yes. And she said, tell me about it, with curiosity, with interest, wide-eyed. And he came alive, describing the outing with his friends and the binge. And she smiled along with him and joined him in that. So with that simple question, was it fun, she had invited the using part of him in. She had let him know he was welcome. He wasn't the bad enemy they were going to banish together. He was part of this treatment. And the therapy was not designed to kill him off, but to get to know him, to understand him, honor him, keep him alive, but find some less destructive way for him to go on. Right? When she had simply supported his determination to stop, then no matter how supportive or kindly she was, the message was that the using part should just go away. But by genuinely being interested in was it fun and going along with his joy, the using part felt welcome. And of course, again, it was that using part that was has to be there if the binging is going to be affected, right? That part has to be part of the therapy and part of the plans to find some other safe ways to have fun. Here's another example from my practice. This is a gay man who grew up in a very religious household and then had spent many years in the military. So for many years of his life, his sexuality was a sort of lonely secret. And by the time I saw him, he was living in New York City, openly gay, totally comfortable. But now, as a high-level executive with a big finance firm, his cocaine use was a shameful secret. So the dynamic of shameful secrecy was continuing. But he came to therapy saying he really wanted to stop using. And one day, he came in, quote, disgusted with himself. He had used again for much of a weekend, felt sick, hungover, had a sinus infection, and he said he never wanted to do that again. I knew that talking to him in that state would do nothing to reach the part of him that came alive over the weekend. I tried to access it, and he got it. He had the language at that point. He said, "The Mark who's talking is the one with the sinus infection and hangover. Mark who uses is nowhere around." So wanting to try and find Mark who uses, which was nowhere around, it was hard. So I just wanted to try to get back to that weekend. And so I started asking into very, very detailed questions about the weekend because, you know, the truth is in the details, right? If you can sort of, if you want to access emotion, sometimes getting somebody to sort of really relive through the details of what they saw, what they smelled, what they felt, you know, like that. So the more we got into the details of that weekend, the more he was able to recall the boredom and loneliness he felt that Friday night. He said he wanted to hole up and not go out. He was too depressed. But then being home alone, not going out, feeling depressed, he was so lonely and bored and antsy. And then as he talked, he suddenly remembered he had actually felt conflict. He had wanted to use but felt conflict about it. He had had no recollection of that before. So he told me then something he had completely forgotten was he took a Vicodin to quiet the voice of dissent and then called his dealer. So then we could talk about that whole process. And at the end of the session, he said, quote, "This was really helpful. In talking about the depression, I felt the part of me who uses enter the room." This was a patient also who used to say, "It happened," whenever he used. I have a number of patients who do that. "It happened." And I always point that out, and it took a long time of my constantly pointing that out, asking him to be curious about his language there. What do you mean, "it happened"? And can you rephrase it, please? I'd like you to say the sentence again, saying, "I used" or "I called," right? And let's talk about that feeling of that "it happened" rather than "I used," "I decided to use," or that leaves room for "I decided not to use." In the words of this patient, he said, "I have finally come to take ownership of my using or not." So from here, I want to move on to process, but I want to stop and talk about this a little bit. Oh, we only have 6 minutes. Any questions? And I really want to talk about some of the process stuff. And can we run over a little?
I'm happy to run over. As you know, okay. People want to stay on, that's fine.
Okay. Or if you want me, I can move on to some of the process stuff, just give some examples and then have questions at the end. If there's
however
no
you
want to
handle it.
Now. Anybody have a burning question about this, or should I talk about the next section and then open it up for questions and discussion? Okay, I'm going to move on. So the last side, process, which relates to transference, countertransference, and which, of course, has a million possibilities and aspects to it, right? I'm going to talk about enactments specifically. Enactments are key in all analytic work, and I think they need to really be considered in substance use work, but they're not usually. Because the work is so behavioral, we often don't pay attention to the relational dynamics, to what is not spoken. But especially with this population, so much is communicated without words. Substance users, I think we all know, are notorious for not having words for their emotions or their experience. And one of the reasons for this is that using a substance is an action that doesn't involve words. It quickly takes away the need for words, right? It changes how you feel. It removes you from a painful situation or a antsy situation or something. It's a solution to something, distress, anxiety, boredom, whatever. It's a solution that doesn't rely on words, doesn't rely on another person's participation, doesn't rely on thinking it through, communicating it, processing it. So taking a substance can be a quick and automatic response. The user doesn't think, doesn't have to even know what's going on. So even if somebody had a skill at communicating once, that can atrophy, right? They're no longer able to do it. Things go from gut to action without going through their cognitive brain at all. No thought, no words, just action. Just do it. And, of course, many people who become addicted have histories of trauma, and trauma is by definition too big for processing with words. It gets stored in the body, expressed through actions. So again, nonverbal, right? So it's only then through the nonverbal process aspects of treatment that we can reach these phenomena, right? Because they can't get processed through reporting because there's no words to report them with. But what happens between us can provide an opportunity to explore and understand what previously could not be talked about, what wasn't even formulated. The same person who wrote years ago about courting surprise, Don Stern, talks about the unformulated and formulating, making something known, formulated, and therefore it can be shared, and sharing it is important. And often once it can be talked about, then the need to medicate with a substance can sometimes diminish, right, if we work on that. Because then we can turn to a fellow human being with distress, or we can think it through. Right? And then choices evolve. Once you can think, you have language to think with, you can make choices. Right? So action and process, can, if we recognize that, can help us then put things into words, recognize them, and formulate them. And then we can look at it. And slips and relapses are certainly communications that bear understanding, right? But there are also subtle enactments that take place within the relationship in the therapy room. And all I'm going to do now is give you two vignettes that I hope sort of demonstrate them, and then definitely hope we have time for questions. So there was a man in his 40s, a successful executive who used cocaine not every day, maybe three times a month. He used alone, secretly, was ashamed, and came to therapy wanting to stop. This man, I'll call him Alan, canceled a session at the last minute, and despite the fact that we had discussed the policy of cancellations, he was furious when he learned he'd be charged for it. When we talked on the phone and he called to cancel and I told him he'd be charged, I didn't know he was angry at all. He's perfectly compliant. But he came in the following session and said he needed to talk about something and then told me he was angry about the charge and uncomfortable paying for it. So we talked about this, and he said it reminded him of how he felt being the youngest brother, pushed around by his older siblings, his overbearing parents, feeling little and not powerful enough to stick up for himself, and now he's sticking up for himself. And shouldn't I be proud of him for that? Well, maybe, but I still have a policy. So we exchanged, we talked about our feelings, and he finally said, "Therapists are Teflon. Whatever I say will have no impact on you. If I said you're a horrible therapist, it would have no impact. You wouldn't even care." And I actually said, "Well, I think I would." And I was told him I was surprised he thought that. And we talked about that. I convinced him that I would actually feel really bad if he said that. And that was a shock to him, that he might actually have some impact on me. With that moment, he suddenly associated to the week before all this happened. He had had a coke slip and told me about it. I had not made this connection at all. He expected me then, when he told me about the coke slip, to chastise him, or somehow take control of it, to have an impact on me. But it turns out, and I was not aware of this at the time, I had thrown it squarely back in his court. I mean, I know I do that, but was not aware of his reactions until this came up. So, as I said before, right, one of the things I do is I help my patient own their own decisions, to know if they use, it was a decision. So he had left that session, when he had told me about the coke slip, feeling, in his words, "Oh, shit. I have to be responsible for this." And then he made the association between the issue at hand, the dispute over payment, and his feeling that I am Teflon, and that coke slip conversation. So then together we realized that he had wanted his coke use to have an impact on me. He wanted me to take charge of it, and it hadn't happened. So the canceled session came along to be used that way, to get a reaction from me. And no wonder he felt I was Teflon, not impacted by what he says or does, because I hadn't been impacted enough by his coke use to step in and take over. I had neither belittled him, like he expected, based on his feeling of being a powerless and angry little boy, nor had I taken care of him and just made him stop and be safe the way a powerless little boy would wish for. So then there was the canceled session and my policy, which he didn't like, right? And he could then test if I did care at all. And once that was articulated, we could explore that dynamic in so many ways, how it's expressed through his cocaine use. Cocaine certainly helps a guy who feels little and impotent to temporarily feel powerful and big. And we could link how important that was to his history, how it manifests between us, and all the manifestations in his life, including his substance misuse. I'm going to go on very quickly because I know we're running out of time. Alice, a 45-year-old school teacher, was in recovery from a longstanding heroin addiction. She was from an upper-middle-class suburban home. Heroin use was really alien to that environment. She was doing well by the time I saw her, but her history was deeply shameful, and she really struggled to accept it in herself. There was this enactment between us, and it actually gave us a way to look at it and for her to understand it. So she came in anxious to tell me about a fight she had had with her husband. As I listened, I heard she was angry at him for just not being in sync with her. So what happened was she got up in the morning. She said to him, let's clean the house. He said, ugh, I'm still tired. I don't want to. In the afternoon, he said, all right, let's go. Let's do some cleaning. She was like, how dare you now? I'm tired now. And I kind of gingerly pointed out to her that all they were on different energy schedules, you know, and she was furious at him for not being on hers. She wasn't on his, and they were just different. Of course, she got furious at me. How could I take his side, not see her point? So then we talked about this and her anger at me for not completely just taking her side. And through that, her wish for perfect attunement at all times became clear. Right? She wanted him to be perfectly attuned to her energy, me to be perfectly attuned to her side of the argument, her feelings there. And she immediately associated this then to what we had been talking about in terms of her mother, who appeared to be a sensitive, caring mom, but really wanted to create her in her own image and rarely saw her or responded to her as she was. She then suddenly said, that's what heroin did. Heroin met that need. Heroin covered that vulnerability left by the lack of attuned parent. Right? Heroin's been described as sort of ultimate nirvana, right? Not exciting high, but perfect comfort and contentment, feeling no needs because needs are met before they exist. That's what she was looking for, right? And her addiction had been a way of communicating what hurt. But it was through this enactment that we were able to get there, to look at it, and for her to be able to understand it, because then we could put words to that, and that allowed her then to put words to her heroin use and what it did for her. And then she could begin to understand it and forgive herself. Okay, I'm going to stop talking. Comments? Is anybody left here?
I'm left.
Okay.
I'm not sure if people have questions or if they want to direct them to you afterwards, but...
Yeah, because it is late. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I mean, I heard a few people drop off at exactly 2. First of all,
yes.
Thank you. This was really helpful. It gave me some real perspectives because I work in a different model, mm-hmm. but this gave me other ways to put what I do, you know, another language to deal with what I'm addressing. So I do appreciate it.
This is Anne from Lancaster.
Hi, Anne.
The two things that came to mind is, first of all, the key focus on dissociation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have ever been as attuned as I became today about that. And obvious because of the trauma, but and the other one was how much the relationship that you're building helped give permission to bring into the therapy room some of the things that, you know, were shameful and needed to be discussed, but were kept completely apart.
Mm-hmm.
So your emphasis on relationship, I think, is clearly critical for this kind of work.
Yeah, I would agree. I think so, too.
Well, listen,
thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you all for calling in.
Yep. Thank you.
And thank you, Dr. Rothschild, for the great presentation.
Sure.
And hope to see you guys in May or June.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody. And yeah,
thank
if there are any
much.
Questions from anybody, you know, who had to hang up early, I'm happy.
Thank you.
Thank
yeah,
you
I've already had several requests for people who had to get off if I could get them the recording for the call. So I'll get that out as soon as I get it from free conference call.
Okay, sure.
That was great. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you, Dr. Rothschild.
Okay.
All right.
Glad to know there were still some people there. Okay.
All right. Well, I'll be in touch with you shortly.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mark. Thanks
a
lot.
Sure.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.